around the country on ABC Radio and the World Wide Web. You're Surfing Australia with Macca on Sunday morning.
Give us a ring, 1300 700 222. Love to talk to you wherever you are. Good morning.
Want a hand, mate? Ring Macca. Someone will give it a go.
Hello, this is Lonnie on the side of the road outside Paluma National Park, North Queensland, just on my way back up to Mossman. I'm a harpist and I've just done a drive down to play at a wedding, my first wedding for the year.
Music makes the world go round and makes Lonnie go round by the sound of things. What sort of things do you play at the wedding? If they come up and say, can you play Stairway to Heaven or Taylor Swift?
Well, that's the forbidden riff. I'm not allowed to play Stairway to Heaven. So I'm classically trained. I studied at the Queensland Conservatorium a couple of years ago, but I've always been a singer as well, and I'm a bit of an everything harpist, classically trained, so I do perform classical numbers, but I love jazz, I love Etta James.
Are you singing while you're playing?
Yeah, yeah.
How good is that? The FNQ Harp Connection.
Yeah, that's it. Thanks, Macca.
Well, whatever. Whatever floats your boat or whatever they say. That was Lonnie last week. She plays the harp and she plays weddings and all sorts of things, I suppose. I don't know how you'd play jazz on the harp. I suppose you could. But then she's got a microphone, so she leans over and sings whatever.
Macca, how you doing? This is Frank Gillespie calling you from Boston, USA.
G'day, Frank.
How are you? I was on your show a couple of times with Finbar Fury and Brendan Grace.
Oh, that's a while ago.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, unfortunately, poor Brendan has passed away since. It's a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been on to Billy Burke. Brendan's grandson is recorded one of Brendan's songs, and Billy sent it to you. You might give it a spin someday. We're looking at getting him over to Australia. He's a very successful young kid. He's only 15 coming up, and he's playing in gigs all over the States at the moment when he's not in school. So his name is Patrick Gillespie. He re-recorded Brendan's song called The Dutchman that was given to him by David Soul from the original Starsky and Hutch many years ago.
Yes.
True story about Alzheimer's. It's a beautiful song that Patrick put his own spin on. And we love your show here. I tune in once in a while when I'm chatting to Billy. He always gives me the information, and it's amazing the way we can get you in so clear over here in the States.
There you go, in lovely Boston. I saw a film last night about Boston when I slumped in my chair. I forget what it was called. Blown Away, I think it was called. But how long have you lived?
Oh, right, yeah.
How long have you lived in Boston, Frank?
Well, on and off, I suppose, for 30 years when I wasn't touring. Boston was always my base, you know. I toured with the Furies, I toured with Brendan. And when I wasn't moving around the world, I was settled back here in Boston. And it's a nice place. There's lots of Irish over here. And actually, as you know, there's 32 counties in Ireland, and we call Boston the 33rd.
Uh-huh. And they tell me...
Yeah.
There's lots of Irish everywhere around the world, and certainly in New York they have the great St. Patrick's Day Parade. I probably have one in Boston. People say to me that the Irish who live in New York sound more Irish now, these days, than the Irish who live back in Ireland, because they came from the diaspora and they just turned up and they kept their Irish accents, whereas it's mellowed a bit in Ireland, you know, so they're much more, they sound much more Irish. That's what they say about New York, and I suppose the same in Boston. Is that true, Frank?
That's very true. Like, I meet people and they say, oh, my God, you never lost your accent. You're here that long? Yeah, you know, so I'm very proud to have my Irish accent. I have a big brogue, originally from Turles Pass in County Westmeath. I have lots of friends gone to Australia to work in the past X amount of years, and they're all very successful over there. And it's just a great country. We love it. And I have to say, We've travelled every city in Australia. And Macca, just before I forget it, we were slow at one of our gigs over there. There wasn't much tickets being sold, and Billy Burke called you in. You gave us a plug, and we ended up selling out the gig. So I want to thank you for that.
Oh, that's all right. That was a while ago. But yeah, we have a lot of people listening around the place here in Australia. But Frank, when was the last time you were in Australia?
The last time I was, it was probably 2014, I think.
Wow, yeah. So 10 years ago.
So, you know, the time flies, and especially then with COVID and everything else, it knocked us back. It knocked the music scene back, as you know, a bit for touring and stuff like that. But I'm going over in June to Ireland, and I'm bringing Patrick, and he's going to do a little recording with Finbar Fury, and Patrick are going to do a song. So that'll be something special.
And how's
looking forward to that.
Yes, you're still tour, Frank. How long have you been on the road with your music?
on and off, probably 30 years.
Uh-huh.
Maybe 35.
And you still you enjoy it still? Because I know a lot of...
I enjoy it.
Go on.
I do different things as well when I'm not on the road. You know, I had a couple of pubs here in Boston and stuff, so it kept me busy. And it was great then to get away with the guys and the gang and touring. And unfortunately, you know, people have slowed down. We're all getting older and stuff like that. But hopefully we'll get a last run of Australia with the Furies one of the days. And I'm hoping to bring my son on tour maybe in a year or so. I get Mark Wilkinson to... grab a few gigs for us, and we'll come in and say hello to you when we're there, hopefully.
Yeah, I heard your song the other day, actually. I think I played it Patrick. Yeah, I think I played it the other day in the office somewhere. I had it and I played it. I don't know. Yeah, but I can't place it this morning as I talked to you. Frank, is the relationship, say, between Boston and New York like it is between Ballarat and Bendigo, Sydney and Melbourne? Rivalry between Boston and New York, is there? Or?
Oh, yeah, there's big rivalry, especially when they play their baseball, the Yankees and the Red Sox. Yeah, big rivalry. And then, of course, you have the American football, the NFL. We play the Giants and the Jets and stuff like that. The rivalry is just, you know, you could cut the atmosphere at the stadium. There's a lot of rivalry. And I won't say over the radio some of the choice language that has been fired. But you know what? It's all good. You need competition. You got to have that.
Yes, exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
I was fortunate enough to. I was at a couple of games Australian rules. I loved it. I was, and Lord be good to Jim Steins. We were there in '92 when he won the Brownlow Medal Award, and it was a very exciting time. It's a great sport. Of course, I love all sports. I'm a good sportsman too. Always tuning in. If it's not golf, it's something else. And I switch over and watch Australian rules sometimes as well.
It's a bit like Gaelic football, isn't it, Frank? Listen, I've got a flag, Frank, I'll play Patrick's song when I find it. It's around the place here somewhere. And look forward to seeing you sometime. Nick's in Signet in Tassie. Morning, Nick.
Morning, Macca.
Hey, how are you going? What's happening?
It's just sunrising down here in Signet. And today we've got apple tasting at a little market in Signet where I'm getting some of the old varieties out for people to have a taste of. I've got 28 heritage varieties all the way from Court of Wick, 1700s in the UK, and Candle Senap from Russia in the 1800s.
Nick, tell me this. do they taste better than apples of today?
That's a good question. I'm not sure we're going to answer that one, Macca. Because tastes do change like fashion. I mean, the clothes you wear nowadays, you probably like the ones that you see in the old movies, but would you wear them?
It's like words change. Like once upon a pond, wicked, sick and filthy meant exactly that, but now they mean good. Yeah. How's the surf? Oh, it's wicked. Oh, how's that? Oh, it's sick. Oh, it's filthy. So the meaning of words changed, so I can understand them, the meaning of taste changes, but I'm not sure. Look, sometimes kids know what they taste something. I remember some littlies and says, that's terrible. Is that salt or sugar?
You're right, though, that people, when they're little, they form their tastes, and when they're older, they try and find those again. We get a lot of I run a small business selling heritage apple varieties, and I get people coming to me saying, oh, I remember that from when I was a kid. Oh, I love that taste. But the modern children aren't getting used to those flavours. They're getting used to just the modern ones they buy in the
they're woke
in the supermarkets.
They're all woke. but I wrote some down on a little booklet. I don't know where my booklet is. What was something nonsuch and all these mighty names they have?
Peas good nonsuch. That's a beauty.
Yeah,
it's quite a large apple, that one.
I don't know if it tastes any good, but I love the name nonsuch.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's passed now. I'm just tasting the ones that are tree ripened at the moment, and are sort of in their prime. Things like Scarlet Nonpareil and Bedfordshire Foundling, all these beautiful old names. It really gives a history, an insight into the history of what it was like to be human in those years.
And most of those developed in England, were they, or where?
No, I've got about a third in England, third in France and Europe, and maybe a third in the USA. I've got a couple of modern ones. My dad's 80. He's still breeding apples, and this one has got red flesh. It's a beauty, and we've affectionately called it Bob's Red because his name's Bob, and this is one of his latest. I'm not sure if it's
so. Where are you doing this apple tasting, Nick? In Signet, is it?
Just in Signet at the town hall.
Geez, I wish I was there today. That'd be lovely. That'd be lovely.
You'd get a bellyache after trying all 28 of them, though.
No, I wouldn't try all the taste of them. And it's useless asking people what they think it tastes like because, as you say, one man's meat is another man's poisson.
And it's interesting to see how people, like the first apple they try, they go, wow, that's amazing. But I guess it's like tasting wine, or you really need to rinse your mouth out in between. Otherwise, after three different apples, you sort of get saturated and go, oh, they all sort of taste the same, or I'm not sure anymore.
Yeah. As somebody said to me recently, why can't you get Jonathan's anymore? Jonathan's used to be wonderful, but it's the same thing, I suppose. What they thought it was wonderful, so, they like a Jonathan anyway.
Look, I just looked up the varieties that sold at Coles these days, and it's amazing. There's the ones I haven't heard of, like Modi or Modi, Kanzi, Smitten, Jazz, Eve, Envy. These are amazing modern apples, and you were wondering earlier what people like or what the best flavour is. People these days, they like a crunchy apple, they like a sweet apple, they like a nice shape and a nice colour.
Mm.
And all these old apples, you know, some of them get really soft and flowery or have a thick skin, and you know, but these days everybody just wants perfection. it's true. And
I know, that's why the joint's going to hell in a handbasket. Anyway, go on.
Exactly. I don't know, these apples that are modern, these are not sort of chance ones that you find on the side of a road that's just a seedling. These are from millions, billions dollar
turnouts,
trials that they plant, you know, 150, 200,000 trees, and then select the very best out of those. They've got a cool store well, they've got a taste well, they've got a shine well.
Nick, next time we come down to Tassie, which I hope is soon, I'm going to look you up and we'll talk more on apples and we can have a tasting. The best thing about an apple is that sound of the crunch when somebody bites into it. Beautiful. I wish you could do it now on the phone, but you can't. Nicky, it's a place to be, the town hall in Signet today. I wish I was there. Good on you, mate. Great to talk to you.
Thanks, Macca. Bye.
See you. Bye. Louisa's in Dalesford. Morning, Louisa.
Morning.
How you going?
Good, good.
That's the way. What's happening?
I'm on my way over to Ballarat this morning to run a half marathon in the first Ballarat Marathon Festival.
Right.
Having left also Manjari, where we've got the Manjari Fair, Central Victoria today. It's a really nice community fair that they put on.
Where's that at?
Uh, at the Botanical Gardens from 10 o'clock.
In Bendigo, you said?
Malmesbury.
What was in Bendigo?
No, Ballarat's the marathon.
So you're going to both places? You're running in the Ballarat Marathon?
No, I'm going to one and I've sent my husband and the children to the other.
So which one are you going to?
The marathon.
I'm
only doing the half.
Half, which is what?
21.1 kilometres.
Louise, why are you doing? It's no good for your knees. All that stuff.
It's not, but I think I'll be watching some of the people finishing the full marathon when I'm about finishing the half. So
yeah, I suppose
that'll be good to see.
You've done this before?
I've done a couple, yeah.
And what's the attraction, Louise?
What's the what, sorry?
The attraction of pounding yourself into oblivion.
Oh, just a nice personal achievement, I guess. It's just nice to get out there. I've got 3 children, so it's a nice outlet.
Yeah, and they're not with you?
No.
They're going to Malmesbury.
I'm asleep in bed. Yeah, oh. they'll go there.
Well, all right. Well, Louise, good luck with the marathon. I've never been tempted to do that. I've never been a runner. But more power to you. I was just talking to a bloke in Boston. Nice. Boston have that big marathon. There's this big marathons around. It must. I'm not sure. I wonder if it does, you know, things to you if you run marathons all the time, all your life, and when you're young, and then it's probably no different. If your knees are going to give out, they're going to give out, aren't they? I think.
I think so. Yeah. Oh, I know we've got a local runner in my local run group, and he's, I think, well and truly into his late 60s or 70s, and he's running marathons in about 3 hours and 30 minutes still. So
yeah, we've got a lady who's about 74, 75. She doesn't run. She shuffles, I think, along. But she does it in about 5 or 6 hours, and she's done some of those, incredible. Like the London and the Boston. So good on you, Louisa. You'll transform into the full marathon sooner or later, I'd say.
Maybe one day when I got time.
Good on you, Louisa. Great to talk to you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. As I said, people are out like Louisa. She's going in doing a half Ballarat marathon, and our swimming correspondent Kieran Kelly's on the beach somewhere. Good morning, Kieran.
Good morning, Ian. Indeed, I am on the beach at Balmoral in Sydney, and I've just spent a lovely 10 or 15 minutes watching the sunrise over North Head, and there were clouds banked up on the horizon, and the sun came up and turned the top of the clouds all pink and then yellow and all different colours of the rainbow, really quite magnificent.
And what are you doing on the beach? You're just doing your normal swim? What's happening?
No, I'm the patron of a swim I started about 15 years ago because I'm a member of the Balmoral Beach Club, and we noticed that people over the age of 60 went off the competition, stopped competitive swimming and racing. And I thought, how can I get these, you know, older people to stay with it? Because I think it's good for them. And I thought, well, Australia's the most competitive people on earth. So if I put a trophy up, name a race, which I did, it's called the Weight for Age. It's based on the Cox Plate in reverse. At being a racing man, you'd know that the older a horse is in the Cox Plate, the heavier the weight it gets. Well, I turned that on its head. So the older the swimmer is, the lighter their handicap. So, of course, this brought all the older people out of the woodwork. They wanted to compete on a basis where an 80-year-old could compete against a 20-year-old. And that's how I handicap it. So I've got an 89-year-old male starting today who's won this race before, Brian Davidson, a former retired lawyer. And Peter McCormack, who's just turned 80, and he's delighted because his handicap really improves. He's a property developer from Mossman. There's all sorts of people trying to win this trophy. And it's succeeded. I set out to encourage older people to keep competing. There's no reason why an older person can't compete. It's just that somehow people think they shouldn't be. Well, they should be. It's good for their health, especially swimming, because it doesn't have any impact on you like marathons do, as you were mentioning earlier. So it's been a great success, really, and people look forward to it every year.
Yeah, I think I was just talking to somebody I can't remember just a little while ago. It might have been Nick about apples, but we were saying it might have been Doug, about competition. Competition is, you know, without going stupid, competition is good for everything, I think, whether it's in manufacturing or sport or whatever, it brings out the best in you, I think, and that's what you're saying about your weight for age, really.
Yeah, well, it's got various aspects to it, one being the continued sense of community. The great thing about going in all these community-type events or competitive events is it makes people socialise with each other. And, you know, there's a fun element to competition, amateur competition. And it's good to see people, you know, still doing it. Some of these people have been competitive swimming since they were 10 years old and now they're in their 80s. So the important thing, too, is to feel part of something as you get older and not lose your social connections, because that's the mental health part of it that I like.
Yeah.
And to see these people enjoying it so much. You know, you're doing something for other people and increasing their joy of life. I love it.
And how many people will go in your weight for age this morning, Kieran?
About somewhere between 60 and 70.
Wow. Holy. And I suppose, see, I've spoken to you since 1989, I think, and I've never heard of this before. You've never told me about the weight for age. I do
a lot of things, then.
I know. But, I mean, I think it's a great thing. And yeah, the more you can, you've got to try and engage people too. And I remember we had a nutritionist in here and she was talking about, you know, what we eat. And as you get older, you tend not to eat as much. And she said a lot of people are diagnosed as having dementia when, in fact, what's happened is that they're not eating properly. And if you don't eat properly and get your proper, you know, sustenance, you'll get a bit foggy around the brain area, you know. So she said it's not always the case, but... Nairi Hobbs, I think, she was a nutritionist, and that's what she said. And so it's important. We all need to be looked after. And, I mean, I think it's a bit like retiring. If you say these people are competitive swimmers and all of a sudden they stop, and that can't be good for the psyche either.
No, I totally agree. As you say, you've got to keep your nutrition up and keep eating sensibly for an older person, but you've got to keep exercising and you've got to keep your social connections up, because otherwise you can become reclusive and, you know, withdrawn, and that's no good either.
Mm.
So the other thing about this, I mean, it is a magnificent morning down here this morning. It's a bit cool. It's 14 degrees. My feet are a bit cold on the sand. The humidity is about 90%, but there's a light westerly blowing and it's absolutely flat in the water, and the water's still nice temperature, about 19 degrees. So it gets people outside. They're not at home. It gets them out of bed. They've got to be down here at 7:30 for the start. So
you've got to do things.
You've got to do things. You've got to get up. You've got to come down here. You've got to put your togs on and your swimming goggles, and you've got to get out there and do it. So this is a wonderful type of environment. It energises me. I'm a country boy, and I love the last call of the Kookaburra, and I love the mopoke at night. I had a mopoke that lived outside my bedroom window. But I do love the sound of the ocean and the vigour of the ocean. I'm a thalassophile. All Australians are thalassophiles. Do you know what that means?
No. Tell me.
a lover of the ocean.
Ah, there you go.
And all Australians are thalassophiles. And I just think this is a very invigorating type of environment than an older person. It's certainly better than staying at home in bed.
Kieran, I'll talk to you next week. Maybe come in next week, and I want to talk about Anzac Day and a few other things too. So come in next week.
Right,
good luck.
Lovely to talk to you, Ian.
Yeah, maybe people go down to Balmoral Beach who don't know anything about it and sign up for your weight for age.
Yeah, well, I can have a look at a lot of very fit over 80-year-olds.
Good on you, mate.
See ya.
Hey, Mac, how are you, mate?
Yeah, good.
I'm just going for a bit of a walk in a park at the moment. It's about 9 degrees in the north part of Perth.
What's your name?
And we're going for my name's Bevan. Bevo. We're going for 24 hours. 24 hours. So your friend there that was driving over to the Ballarat Running Festival.
That was Louisa. Yeah, Louisa's going to the Ballarat. She's only doing the half marathon. God help me. That's 20K. Yeah, exactly.
She's only doing 21K.
Yeah.
I've clocked up 65K already on a walk as part of this 24-hour event that we do. And some of these guys are running past me pretty quickly, and all up they might do about 100 laps. And in a 24-hour event from 3 p.m. Saturday to 3 p.m. Sunday, they might get 250 kilometres under the belt.
Bevo, where's in Perth, whereabouts?
Yeah, I'm the normal famous stuff. People know it pretty well. Ocean Reef is the main road around, and Woodvale is the suburb. And then there's Perry's Paddock. It's got the Beanyup Swamp, and we're pretty much walking 2.5k laps around a council park. There's a bit of limestone, bit of asphalt, bit of dodgy track as well, roll an ankle on. And then there's a bit of boardwalk. So under the moonlight tonight, she's a beautiful night. We'd normally go with a headset lamp and just to guide us through, but I don't need that this morning.
What's the deal, Bevo? Why you? This is an organised ultra marathon. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, there's a company that put these on, and there's multiple other things as well. But this one's specific for me. I heard you play a song earlier out of the 5 o'clock. And by the way, it's only about 4:35 o'clock here for us in Perth. And it was the song about the 10th Light Horse. And this is what this is about. This event is called the Light Horse Ultra. You sign up for it. You get to 24 hours on your own. And if you can make it to the end, you get yourself a decent medal. And you can say to your mates, I've clocked up 100K, or you've made a personal best. And maybe you can do 250. So
and how
some
many
of the guys are on track.
So this has been going all weekend?
Yeah, started at 3 p.m. yesterday, 3 p.m. Saturday our time. And the 12-hour runners, they started at 3 a.m. And we're all gathering shortly for a stand too. There's another one of the speeds just going past me. The thing I love about this light horse is that the organisers, they involve it on the Anzac weekend, which is the weekend closest to Anzac Day. And it's about the remembrance of those that have fallen. And you can come and walk 24 hours or run 24 hours and test yourself. So we're going to stand to shortly at 5:30-ish. It's always a...
And Bevo, how far will you have walked, do you reckon, by the... You're walking, aren't you? Or jogging?
No, I'm just cruising. Yeah. You were talking about knees and old man injuries earlier on. My knees are a bit wonky. I was able to do 110K in my completion last year. And my heart was saying I might do 100 this year. The body was probably saying 70. But my knee was telling me, don't start, don't go, don't get in the car, don't do this. What are you thinking? So I also got to say, Macca, I'm lucky these things aren't drug tested because I'm on a few prescriptions.
Bevo, what do you do for a living? Are you work?
I'm a technician that plays with transmitters.
there's a wide what sort of transmitters?
An NV10 which puts out 8.2 kilowatts of FM.
I see. Like a radio technician, or is it radio?
A competitor. For a competitor, but you're the auntie, so I'm allowed on this one.
And what's that like?
Always a good fun. As you've probably seen, I'm listening on the app at the moment through the Sydney stream. And there's a few changes happening in the city market, but I'm not able to speak for those things, so I need to exit that part of the conversation and come back to what we talked about. You don't get fired these days, Macca.
I see.
Jobs are hard to find.
Yeah, I'll say. Bevo, so you'll finish this, what, the latest today?
Yeah, 3 p.m. is the finish time for the 24-hour runners. They 3 a.m. so they do 12 hours.
So how many people are doing this?
Yeah, 300 have signed up for all the events, like a 24, 12, or 6-hour, maybe a 3. But there's 100 in the there's men and women in the 24-hour started yesterday.
Well, there you go.
So this is a cheeky dig at your Louisa that's driving from wherever to Ballarat to go and run the 21K. Maybe step up at 42 or come and do some ultra series stuff.
Gee, well, you have to be keen, mate. You have to be keen, and you want to take care of your knees too. Look, I'm not sure if the use it or lose it mantra goes that if you don't keep walking or whatever, you'll really lose your knees. So I suppose you've got to do some, but. Yeah,
who's your good friend from the Balmoral beach that you were talking to earlier?
Oh, Kieran. Yeah, Kieran.
Yeah. Like you said as well, you know, he tried to find something to make sure that those over 60-year-olds are able to be included, and because competition finishes, he wanted to make sure that they participate.
Yeah.
This is what this is about. If you want to extend yourself and test yourself, if you've got some time, get out and go for a 20K walk on the weekend and step it up, and before you know it, you're running 100K.
Yeah, you're in Perth, and you've had I was going to say a bugger, but I won't. You've had a terrible time, really. It's been a really hot, dry time in Perth. The last seems to me when I watch and look at the the thing, the last two or three months have been, you know, I think, you know, I don't mind a few hot days, but you've had months and months of it.
We have. Your opener out of the news was talking about the long dry period. Mm. I heard one of the duty forecasters talking, it's just nothing for the next month. They talk about the troughs off the coast and all over my head, but I get what she's trying to say is that it's just gone. It's just not there. And what would normally come south to us to give us the rain ain't coming. So the hot days have stayed. Look, there's many other dramas in the world, but my lawn died. I'm not paying the local council 300 squillion to water it.
No. And you don't have to mow it either. But usually the West and certainly Perth and environs, you get your winter rain. So we can only hope that winter, when that starts, around June, that you'll be getting some decent rain. But it's been a really dry, and then other parts of Australia have just been drenched. What a country we live in.
Those days where Perth's on fire and there's floods through the Coffs Harbour, all those sort of things, up the northern coast.
Yeah, exactly.
It's 3,000 kilometres across and just a vast economy.
And you were referring to, that was Kieran Kelly who rang just before the news. Kieran's down in Sydney on Balmoral Beach, and he's organised this thing for the last 15 years. It's called the Wait for Age, and he's got an 89-year-old because he said we've got to look after older people and get them out and get them exercising. So I think he's got 70 or 80 people in their 60s, 70s and 80s, 89, and he's still swimming, and they just do a little swimming race, and it's handicapped, and they have younger people and older people. And it's not really serious, but competition is good for you. So, Bev, I suppose you're competing with yourself in terms of what you can do and what you did last year and that sort of thing.
As an observation, around Australia, the Oxford charity have been organising events, sort of trail walker, but that's where you need to get a team of four together. And that relies on the others. So this one's merely a case of if your knee gives out, then you can stop. You can take 3 hours at a stop station if you need to, other than holding up a team. So kind of, for me, I like the individual part of this. It's a challenge you can set yourself, and you're only organising one person rather than the four. And it's a good thing. You mentioned with Kieran as well, the age of that. We've got people in the 70s that going around. If you were to check one of the results things for the Ultra Series, you'd see that they're doing pretty much better times than me, the 52-year-old.
Bevo, when we get to Perth sometime later this year, we'll look you up and we'll have a yarn, okay?
Clear skies here, so she's a cold morning. It's just gone 5:30. I'm feeling the chill. I've got the hand warmers out and they're warming me up nicely.
Good on you, Bevo.
Happy days. Cheers, Macca.
Morning, Macca. Tony here. I'm at West Wylong, travelling towards Melbourne from Tomingley picnic races yesterday.
All right, how'd they go?
Oh, it's a great day. All of these picnic meetings are fabulous community events. The community really get behind them, and racing should be doing more for them and supporting them more. But it was a wonderful day out there. No winner, but a lot of grinners. And, just a great thing to be involved in. And I've been listening to your program this morning, and Kieran with his older people and the swimming and the half marathon and whatever. It's just wonderful to be at these events because the positivity at a lot of these events is just, it's just building. You know, you get there, it's just wonderful to be involved. And even with the picnic races, at 63 years of age, I started riding again at the picnics after not having ridden for 44 years. And look, it's probably financially not viable. Is it wise? Probably not. And a lot of my friends tell me that. But just to be involved and be able to do it again is something I can't describe to you. And just the thrill of it all again is wonderful. So, you know, these small picnic meetings around the state are just such community-orientated events. The racing, sure, it's not at Randwick, it's not at Flemington, it's not. And the horses are, you know, their life is prolonged by racing at these events. And any horse in work is really looked after well. And for me to be competing against teenagers and 20-year-olds is just, it's great. And they treat me well.
Yeah, I think the other thing about people getting together and community is probably because of the last 3 or 5 years, I don't know, and people I think people cherish more, mostly, most of us, the vast majority of us, cherish the fact that we can get together and talk to people. We're of a generation where talking on the phone doesn't do much for you, whereas face-to-face and being in a group of people and people just chatting to one another, there's something very human about that. So it could happen at the Tomingley races, or it could happen anywhere at a fete or a quilt exhibition or whatever, where people of like mind get together. Tony, I think that's...
Yeah, look, unfortunately the world's changed a lot. And I did something a few weeks ago. We raced at Bourke, and I actually sat down and wrote a letter to the committee and to where my accommodation was and whatever. And no one does that anymore. I don't do it anymore, and I just decided I should start doing those things. And look, the contact you make with people, and we all used to like getting letters. We all like to go to these community events. And, you know, we should be supporting the communities more than we do. And it's wonderful to hear some of your stories today of people doing the half marathons. I mean, I've done 20 half marathons. I've done a couple of fulls. They're bloody hard. No mistake.
You don't have to tell me. It's a struggle for me to run up the street. Tony, did you used to ride professionally as a jockey?
Look, when I was a kid, 1975, I was apprenticed at Flemington to a trainer called Pat Bourke. And unfortunately, I was always too heavy. I had 19 rides, and I did ride 4 winners as an apprentice, and went into the bloodstock world after that. And that's what I've done all my life. Worked in England, was managing director of Goffs UK over there for 3.5 years. I've worked in bloodstock and with horse farms all my life, and had a couple of farms of my own. I've been involved for, this is my 49th year. And so to be involved again in a different way back to riding, just at the picnics, it's fantastic. And next week I'm going to Boorowa, and to be involved, a friend's kids who are only 18, 20, 22, that sort of age, have bought a horse specifically for me to ride next week at Boorowa. So how could I not ride that? And it's just wonderful to be involved with young people, involved with kids, and that keeps you young too. And I didn't want to be 70 and say I should have. So you've got to do these things. And I'm a person that, well, for your listeners out there, I could have ridden 61 kilos 3 weeks ago, and that's 39 kilos down on what I was a year ago.
Wow. Well, good on you, Tony. Nice to talk to you, mate. And you're in West Wyalong this morning, are you?
Yeah, I'm travelling to Melbourne at the moment, and I'll be back up in Scone where I live probably late next week or early the week after.
And a weather report quickly for West Wyalong?
I don't know what the temperature... it's not bad. I'm only in a shirt, and it's not too cold. Beautiful day down here, and it'll be a nice day. So it'll be a nice trip to Melbourne, and it's nice to listen to your program.
Thank you.
And to some of the interesting people that get on the show.
I'll say they're all interesting to me. Good on you, Tony. Thank you.
No worries. Thank you, Macca.
Bye. It's a pleasure.
Hi, Macca. It's Chris here.
Chris.
I just wanted to share with you and your listeners, and thank you for taking my call. I have a friend called the Reverend Bill Morgan, who's 108. Actually, he's 108 and a half.
Really?
God help me. And last Wednesday, he celebrated 80 years since his ordination. And he preached at the retirement village where he lives. And he's so inspiring. He's got more brains than you and I put together.
That wouldn't be hard for me.
So inspiring.
What's his name, Chris?
Bill Morgan, Reverend Bill Morgan.
And he's 108 and a half. My
yep.
God, I shouldn't, you know, I'm not laughing. I just think that's just amazing. 80 years ordained.
Yeah. And on the 2nd of June at 2 o'clock at the Glen Waverley Uniting Church, they're having a special service. And it would be lovely if old parishioners could come along, including people. He actually worked in Vanuatu for a period. And there are some people around who might know him from that time. And if you've got a moment, I'll tell you a story.
Go.
I went to Vanuatu a bit over a year ago to help them vaccinate for COVID so they could open up again after the COVID to tourists. And when I came home, he said hello to me and spoke to me in their language. He still remembers. It's amazing.
Amazing fella. So that's on the 2nd of June, the service. Where's that at?
At 2 o'clock at the Glen Waverley Uniting Church. It's one of the suburbs of Melbourne. It's on the corner of the Kingsway and Bogan Avenue.
Well, I hope he's still alive. I mean, when I hear...
He's very much alive, believe me.
Well, I know that, but what I'm saying is, you know, I've had friends who were, 103 and whatever, and then next thing you turn around, they're gone. So I hope he survives. 108, that's an age and a half, Chris, isn't it?
It's incredible, and he's so self-effacing. He said, oh, it's not what I've done, it's what God's done for me. And for everyone. So we're very lucky to have him.
2nd of June at the Glen Waverley Uniting Church. That's a lovely story.
Yep.
Isn't that lovely? Bill Morgan.
Incredible.
Bill Morgan. Yeah. 108 and a half. I should talk. Is he a good talker?
He's a bit deaf. And he did the sermon and the whole service without any prompts because his vision, unfortunately, he's been a great reader, but his vision's deteriorated lately. So he did it. He quoted the Bible and did all his sermon and everything just off pat.
Life can be very inspirational, Chris, can't it? Good on you.
It's wonderful to find some inspirational people, and you're one of them. No, thank you, Macca, for all you do.
That's a pleasure. Good on you, Chris.
For our society.
Okay,
thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for taking my call.
That's a pleasure. It's lovely.
Bye-bye.
It's Alfie Smith from Paul's Presbyterian Church, Lismore. Just to let you know, we are back in the church today after 2 years and 2 months.
After
devastation from the 2022 flood.
Oh, and today there's a service, is there, Alfie, in your church?
Yeah, back in our church after 2 years and 2 months. Anybody listening, please turn up. Our service at 9 o'clock to see how our church has been restored to its normal way it was before.
So that's St. Paul's in Lismore. I'm sure lots of people, if you're listening around Lismore, and even if you're wherever you are around the place, Bangalore or Byron Bay, for God's sake, get up to Lismore. So how's Lismore looking generally, Alfie?
It's looking, fairly good. It's still a long, long way to go to be back to what it was normally, but we just pray for God that it will come back.
Well, if you want some inspirational lift, go and have a look at St. Paul's in Lismore. I haven't seen it, Alfie, but if I get up that way in the next month or two, I'll come and have a look at it, okay?
That's right.
So that's today at 9 o'clock. It's pity.
9 o'clock in St. Paul's. And it's Alfie Smith, the session clerk of St. Paul's Presbyterian Church, that's speaking to you now.
Good on you, Alfie. It's great to talk to you, mate.
Yeah, glad to talk to you too. Thanks, Macca. God bless you.
It's a pleasure, mate. Good on you.
Thank you.
This is the All Over News.
I play this little track because I just received an email from John Howie from the Howie Brothers, and he says, a couple of years ago I read a fantastic book about the Alberts music publishing business, and I think the book was called The House of Hits. I learned so much about the history of the music industry in Australia, as Alberts was involved in many aspects of the music industry, think ACDC. One thing I learned was that most of the mouth organs sold in Australia and New Zealand from about the 1840s till the 1950s were sold by Alberts. And although the mouth organs came from Germany, Alberts were allowed to put their own brand name on them. The brand name they chose was Boomerang. The book explains that prior to World War I, mouth organs were a huge fad, and many soldiers took mouth organs to the First World War, as they were pretty much the only musical instrument they could fit in their army kit. I thought you might be interested, Ian, in my poem, How Many Little Boomerangs, on your program. I am John, and this is it. How many little boomerangs lie buried in the sands at Suvla Bay, Gallipoli and other foreign strands? How many little boomerangs no longer make a sound? Just rusting bits of tin now on some great war battleground. These lovely little instruments, once cupped in loving hands, now lie unloved where trenches once lined hellish no-man's lands. Such handy little instruments, they easily would fit inside an Anzac soldier's regulation army kit. That's how so many travelled all those miles across the sea, from Australia and New Zealand to spots like Gallipoli. In Australia and New Zealand in the years before the war, harmonicas were all a rage, and a Sydney music store called Albert's sold near all the mouth harps everybody played, and on each one the brand name Boomerang was proudly blazed. And they're the little boomerangs that travel to the war, to spots like Villers Bretonneux, the Somme, and Bullecour. So how many little boomerangs then made it to the war? At a guess, I'd say there must have been 5,000, maybe more. And think of what it must have meant to our boys over there to hear the soft, sweet sound of a mouth organ in the air. It must have seemed a little bit of heaven and had just landed in their crazy world where death and guns and suffering were standard. I picture our boys singing in a group, all having fun, with a mouth organ accompaniment to keep them all as one. Singing Pack Up Your Troubles and other songs they knew, like Three German Officers Crossed the Rhine, Parlez-vous. But sadly, many of our boys, they never made it home to Australia and New Zealand, their remaining years to roam. They lie buried, far from home, having paid the ultimate price, and forever we'll remember their brave deeds and sacrifice. And how many little boomerangs likewise did not return to the land of emu, kangaroo, kiwi and silver fern? How many little boomerangs? I guess we'll never learn. Unlike their Aussie namesake, were never to return. Yes, how many little boomerangs lie buried in the sands at Suvla Bay, Gallipoli and other foreign strands? How many little boomerangs no longer make a sound? Just rusting bits of tin now on some great war battleground. This is the All Over News, and it's no news to anyone really that Aussies have had a great love affair with their cars. And it's not a great leap to realise that the petrol and the oil that we put into them and the tyres we put on them occupies a similar space in our hearts. Golden Fleece, Ampol, COR, etc., etc. About a year ago, I spoke to Colin Dennett about a book he'd written, A Pictorial History of Ampol, which of recent times has come back into the Australian fold. Last week, a postscript to that book arrived, a chapter 10, if you like, including the story of Total. You remember Total service stations, garages. Plus, more stories of Ampol, radio, Jack Davey. I couldn't believe it. It's sort of a total recall in a postscript. But once Colin Dennett found new info and photos, oh, you should see the photos, he just had to do a postscript.
Many will remember Total service stations throughout Victoria particularly. And
everybody remembers Total. I mean, we're wedded to our petrol brands, aren't we?
Yeah, except that Total didn't extend to South Australia, Western Australia or Tasmania. It was basically an eastern state operation, but it's well known. Anyway, what happened was they pulled the pin back in 1983, and after 25, 26 years of operation in Australia, and Ampol bought them out. And that's long forgotten, 44 or 5 years ago.
The nice thing about this book, it's just like you've written another chapter, basically about Total and also about Ampol and about radio. The thing about Jack Davey, who was a big star, and Ampol really sort of owned him for, 5 or 10 years. The amazing thing is there's a picture here of the Ampol show. There's 3AW and all those sort of stations, but there's the Ampol show here, and Jack Davey, and there's a band on board, and it says here, Jack Davey at Extreme Far Left on Stage Auditorium, and audience was the way many radio shows were produced. The ABC, for instance, employed a full orchestra to support the many live broadcasts, and there's a picture here of the band on stage, and there's a trombone playing. I'm sure it's my dad. I'm just dead set positive. That's my dad playing trombone, because I remember he used to play for the Jack Davey Show and Macquarie and all those sort of things, so that's probably him.
There you go. And that, what you've just said, Ian, is exactly what's happening. Even with this postscript that's only been out a matter of a couple of weeks, people have been coming in about photographs, for instance, identifying and confirming. What you've just said is quite unbelievable. But that's the beauty of books, I think.
And the photos of old... I mean, something's lost and something's gained in living every day. I always use that quote. But you see these photos of these, not only the old petrol drums and oil drums with total on them, but the old petrol stations or garages, as they were known, and they're just wonderful things of the past, aren't they? And as you say, if it wasn't for a book, we wouldn't be able to get hold of them.
No, we're pieces of history, and because I got onto a lost collection of photographs of the early total service stations from the 50s, probably through to the mid 60s or thereabouts, and there's scenes there that long gone. These are historical identities. And then there was all the infill, and they were interested in little tin-pot places, one brand, one Bowser outlets in some cases, just to get market penetration. So they did quite an amazing thing. And as you said, they will be well remembered by the people, and those who don't, well, they can learn all about it in the book.
I used to think there was a lot of petrol stations, petrol brands when I was a kid, but yep. I just made a list of the ones that are around now. Gull, Enhance, Metro, BP, Speedway, Budget, Coral, Shell, Liberty, Ampol, United Petroleum, Caltex, 7-Eleven, and there's and there's Coles and Woolworths, of course, and there's Independent and Prime. It's amazing, isn't it?
Well, back in the day, I think we had about seven majors, but that's right. What you've just indicated is that there's a lot of, like Mobil, for instance, doesn't have its own outlets in Australia today, but they're behind Metro and 7-Eleven, and you've added more there that I wasn't aware of either. It's a complex, very complex market, but an intriguing market, and one we couldn't do without even in the current climate. The derivatives and byproducts from oil are going to be with us for many years to come. It was worth recording, and I'm so pleased I've done it, because had I not, some of this stuff would have just slipped by, I think, and been lost. But the likes of guys like John Hilder, who opened up and provided so much information that I would never have known about, just wonderful to have it now in a format where many can enjoy it. So I'm very pleased I've done it.
It's a wonderful little postscript, this postscript Chapter 10 of An Illustrated History of Ampol that you browse through. I just love looking at the old garages, as I think they were called, and colour photos of all those lovely oil drums, and people collect those. It's a big collecting things now, isn't it?
Oh, big, not only the enthusiasts, that they should really appreciate this sort of thing, I'm sure they will, but it's the people who generally aren't aware of just how complex the market was back then. And all these little companies play their part. Yeah, I'm just so pleased it's all there, and I couldn't have ever rested in without finally getting this down on paper.
We all love the present and think about the future, but the past always has a hold on us, doesn't it?
My word, and so easily forgotten. We can look up and see these things on the internet, but there's nothing like a book. Thanks very much for you, and so pleased that you found your father. I mean, that was quite unexpected.
Colin Dennett, thank you very much. Nice to talk to you.
Pleasure to talk, and thanks for your interest, Ian.
Last week, Susan Carney emailed me and she said, Ian, the New South Wales State Government, in their wisdom, have decided to remove the Ulmarra Ferry, which is an essential service in our community. Not only an essential service, it has historical value. The ferry is pivotal to our community. It's our public transport across the river for farmers, workers, school children, aged care, emergency services and the general community. It becomes a 76K round trip without it. Crazy decision. Our military correspondent Lynette Silver's on the line. Good morning, Lynette.
Good morning, Ian.
How you going? Where are you?
Oh, good. Right now, and this, everybody would die for this view, I'm about 3,000 feet at the top of a hill, looking at, my husband just said 4,000, looking at Mount Kinabalu, which rises another 10,000 feet above me, and it's absolutely superb. The sun's just come up.
And you've been to Sandakan and environs.
Yes, we took 16 relatives from various states to the service for Anzac Day, and after that was over, we started to trace the death march route in a bus, not walking this lot, but in a bus, and going to various spots to see where their relatives died, and as usual, it's been a very emotional experience for all of them.
I'll say, and you do, Lynette, I was just thinking, you've done this for, you know, how long, 10, 15 years?
25 years.
25 years, my God. And the temperature over there, what's it, hot and humid, is it, and sticky?
Well, when you're not up in the mountains, yes, it's very hot and humid, like Singapore. If people have been there, you know, you just stand there and drip sweat sometimes. But the weather hasn't been too bad for the first few days, and people get used to it after a while. And, of course, with the heat, they appreciate what it was like for the people, the soldiers sent on the death marches. You know, no food, no proper clothes, terribly sick and terrible climate to contend with.
Every time, and they've played war movies this week because of Anzac Day, so there's all sorts of war movies about all sorts of things, and I just can't, you know, talk about a privileged life that I've read, born after the Second World War and all those sort of things, missed out on Vietnam and didn't have to, you know, go, and I just think of the things that all soldiers go through wherever they are. Once bombs start exploding and, you know, you get blown up and your feet get blown off, whether you're in Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever, all the things that Australian soldiers, we have no idea, Lynette, do we? We just have no idea. It's
well, something very, very confronting happened to me at the Anzac Day service. I was introduced to two Japanese gentlemen whom I'd never met before. I'd never seen any Japanese at the Anzac Day service ever. And I was asking the older one where his family was during the war, and he said Tokyo, and then he said, "I am the grandson of General Barber." Well, General Barber's the fellow we hanged for the death marches.
Oh, wow.
So I was a bit rocked on my feet at that point, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. And
it was just fortunate I didn't have any of the group with me. I don't know how they would have managed to cope with that, knowing that their relatives dead because of General Barber.
Well, it's not, I suppose, the grandson's fault, but what did he say anything else? I mean, why was he there?
He was there as an act of reconciliation on his part, trying to come to terms with what had happened back there and what his grandfather had been hanged for. So I thought it was very brave of him to come across and come to an Anzac Day service. I was quite amazed.
It makes me think about war, you know, and the Germans, they talked about the fatherland and British Mother England and the motherland, and I look at the Japanese, and every time you see a film, it's you do this for the emperor. And he had a lot, the emperor had a lot to answer for, didn't he? But I suppose he was a product of his time too, wasn't he, of another generation of Japanese that if the emperor said this, well, you die for the emperor, which is quite crazy.
Yes,
and
they
died.
Regarded him.
Yeah, go on.
Sorry, they regarded him as a god.
Mm.
And the problem with our prisoners of war was that, according to the Japanese, they're supposed to have killed themselves when they surrendered, right? Not leave thousands and thousands of people that they had to look after. So consequently, when they were in prison camps, they were treated very badly, basically because the Japanese code in their army was a very brutal sort of regime, but more because they were prisoners of war, and I wouldn't be stuck here minding you if you had the decency to kill yourself. And that was a huge problem because all of our POWs suffered from that same sort of mentality.
Yeah, so you've been over there now, what, for 2 weeks?
Fortunately, we arrived. I was going to ring you up last week from Singapore, but there was a volcano erupted at Sulawesi, which is the next island across from here, and the flights were cancelled. So I was very busy that morning trying to find out if we had a flight, and we did, thank goodness, because they cancelled flights for 2 days because of the ash cloud. So we did arrive, which was a bit stressful getting everyone here, and we arrived here on the 21st of April, and we won't be going home till, I won't be going home till the 3rd of May. And we've been to all the POW places. This group walked a little bit along the death march track, and you know, that's a very good thing for them to do, especially those who died up here at Ranau. They're literally walking in the footsteps of their relative, and as I said, it's always been the most moving experience because, you know, these people for years and years and years, until my book came out, basically nobody knew what had happened to anybody. Now, that book came out, it's been in print now for nearly, 25 years? Yes. And people still ring me up, you know, every single week, or they email me to ask me what happened to Grandpa or somebody. And, you know, it's absolutely outrageous that 80 years on, this information is denied to these people because the Australian government decided back in 1945 that what happened here was so terrible you couldn't tell anybody. So all they got was a telegram saying died prisoner of war in Borneo, and that was it. And yet there were reams and reams of paperwork. If someone had gone through it, which they got from the Japanese, to actually sort out what had happened to all these people. And that was my job when I did my book. And I thought that was the end of it, but it was only the beginning.
Yeah, well, you know, more power to you. And that's what happens unless people like you, and there's lots of examples of all across all sorts of subjects, including war, but unless somebody sits down and does it, it doesn't happen. And governments in lots of ways are really, you know, there must be a better way, but we haven't discovered a better way. And maybe it's the way people approach public service these days. I don't know, but it was always the way. Do you know what I mean? And everybody's, oh, no, you can't do that. It's a rule. And yeah, it's...
Well, the army agreed too. The army, there was no censorship for us after the war. We never had what they call D notices, which is gagging the press. The British did, but we didn't.
And she's gone.
Censorship.
Oh, sorry, yeah, go on.
Yeah, during the war they were constrained by the normal censorship. Mm. And when all this stuff started to emerge, when, you know, investigators got here, they actually managed to convince the editors of the newspaper not to print any details that would tell any of the public who were the victims or what unit they belonged to, and it was kind of just a generic reporting. And because of that, there was reporting in the press of things that had happened, but nobody knew actually who they were. So because the nasty stuff was printed in the press, everybody imagined that everyone that went on the death march was bayoneted to death or had their head cut off or something. And the real answer is that, yes, some were shot because they couldn't go on, but the rest managed to reach their destination only to die of the conditions there. So the biggest thing for most people is that they imagine that their relatives on the death march who died were beheaded on the way and just left there. And that's simply not what happened.
Lynette Silver, I think you're a champion, and that's one of the reasons why you're the Australian all over of our year this year. We're busily trying to get the names engraved on there, which is it's a lovely. You saw it, didn't you? It's a lovely.
Oh yes,
it's a lovely.
I actually held it for all 5 seconds before you took it back.
Yeah. Well, maybe we could get some miniatures made, like yeah. But I don't know. That'd be not, because we've been doing this for nearly 20 years now. But Lynette, it's wonderful work. And yeah, I'm not sure I'd like to be in Borneo this morning, but it'd be nice up on top of the mountain, I'm sure.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's like being at Katoomba. You know, it's very, very cool. There's no aircon here at the hotel because you don't need it.
Uh-huh.
So you have the windows with all lovely fresh air, mountain air coming in. It's wonderful. But any of the listeners, if they do have a relative who died in Sandakan, always contact me through my website, which is just lynettesilver.com, and there's a spot there you can say contact me and I'll be able to tell you what happened, and I'm very pleased to be able to do it.
Great to talk to you, Lynn. See you when you get back.
Okay. Thanks, Ian.
See ya.
Goodbye, everybody. Goodbye, Ian. Bye.
My name's Justin. I'm in Harvey, West Australia.
All right.
And it hasn't rained here for a long time, and there's a lot of people out on the land doing it pretty hard, and they're in for another hard month or so. Hopefully it rains, maybe next week there's a bit of rain forecast, but it's been pretty bad here.
It has sort of rained here since. Yeah, and I've noticed the temperature, and I've noticed the fact that it's not raining, and a bloke rang us from Boyup Brook last week. I played a little grab of it this morning, I just talked to Bevo in Perth. The ultra marathon's on today. It's been on this weekend, actually. Yeah. Justin, have you got a place? You farm, do you?
Yeah, I'm not really a farmer. I trade cattle. I do a few things, and one of them's trading cattle, and just trying to get fodder. Obviously, people are, you know, having to get rid of their cattle because they didn't have any hay at the beginning of the year, and they can't afford to buy it anymore now. So I'm sort of trading cattle. I'm buying cattle obviously very cheaply, and then trying to keep them alive, hoping it rains, and been taking a gamble for a while and hasn't come off too well at the moment. As I said, there's a bit of rain forecast for Tuesday, but it's going to be a good 6 weeks or so until we get any feed. And I'm doing it pretty well because it's not really my main source, but there's a lot of people out there doing it very hard between here and Esperance.
That's the great gamble, isn't it, of farming? You know, people, you know, they feed cattle and they keep feeding. They see, oh, it'll rain, they keep feeding, and it can happen that it all goes to hell, you know, and it, you know, doesn't come, and all of a sudden they're in debt up to their eyeballs and all those sort of things to keep us fed, I suppose, to make a living, but to keep everybody fed. And it's a gamble. They say it's a gamble. Life's a gamble, but certainly farming when you get weather like that. And as I said, the rest of it, not the rest, most of the rest of the country's been inundated with rain. And, you know, we're supposed to, the bomb said earlier, you know, in September or October or something, a drier than usual summer and spring and summer. But that was... that maybe was forecast for Western Australia.
Wrong side of the country.
Yeah,
they got it right. Just got the wrong side of the island.
Exactly. So, Justin, you're in Harvey, and that's where you base your work. What else do you do to keep heart and home together?
I was a horse trainer in a previous life, and I race a few thoroughbreds nowadays and a few paces and breed a few greyhounds as well along the way. But right. So I've got plenty to do there. But one of the things, Macca, that I've never seen before is the native bush here is dying in places up on the sand ridges. It's the tea tree and the jarrahs and that right along the coast in Australind are turning it up, which no one's ever seen before.
That's what our correspondent last week said. I've got to go, Justin. Good on you, mate. Thanks for your call.
Thanks, mate.
Chloe's in Mansfield. Good morning, Chloe.
Hi, Macca. How are you going?
Yeah, good. Thank you.
I was just calling to tell you about Flynn's Walk that's on today down in Williamstown.
Is this Errol Flynn or...?
No. So this is a walk for veterinary surgeons in Australia. It's all about raising awareness around suicide and mental health in the industry, because the veterinary industry has a 4 times greater suicide rate than the general population.
Uh-huh. I heard that. Yeah. I heard that about dentists too. One time.
Yeah. I think a lot of the medical professions, it really hits hard. You know, we're working long hours. We've got, we're dealing with people on really bad days and a lot of really emotional stuff. So it can be a bit tough. But yeah, the walk's named after Flynn Hargreaves, who passed away due to suicide in 2018, and. His family and friends got together and made this walk, and now they do it in all the capital cities and Wagga. So, yeah.
And how long does the walk take? What is it, Chloe?
It's 7Ks along the Esplanade in Williamstown.
So, and Chloe, you're a vet?
Yep, sure am.
And why do you think it manifests itself more in the medical profession? What do you think, stress or?
Yeah, I think, look, it's probably stress. Since COVID, I've found, you know, we're all out and about more, we're doing more things in the veterinary industry, where there's less vets and less vets doing after hours. So at the moment, my clinic does after hours for quite a large area. So we're seeing people that we wouldn't normally see, just because other clinics in the area don't have enough vets to do the after hours.
There's not enough everybody, is there, Chloe?
It's a problem across a lot of industries.
As I mentioned earlier this morning, I bumped into a couple of solicitor lawyers the other day, ladies, in having a spag, and they were telling me, I said, how's things to one of them? She said, well, look, I used to employ 12 people, but now I'm down to 5 and I can't get them.
Oh, gosh.
And that was in a regional area. So, you know, it's right across the board. Now, tell me, my producer, Lee Kelly, has asked me to ask you about Swiss Parrot. I know about Swiss Parrot.
Yeah, so last weekend I headed up to Chiltern. I'm a bit of a birder. Mm. To see the swift parrots. So there's only 2,000 of them left in the wild, and they're a migratory parrot. So they spend half of the year over in Tasmania, and then they come over to the mainland.
They cross Bass Strait, don't they? It's a great little story.
Yeah, they're beautiful little parrots, and a really healthy population in Chiltern. So last weekend there was about 50 there at the dam in the morning, and there was about 30 in the afternoon, came down for a drink, and it's just... It's a magical sight to see them and hear them all chattering, and yeah, it was great.
So they migrate, if I can use that word. What time of the year they come over to the mainland? When in winter?
Usually around the start of April. They were there a little bit early this year. And there's some populations over in Ararat in Western Victoria, around Lake Fyans. The ones in Chiltern were the ones that I went to see. And there's quite a few birders up there at the moment. I met some really lovely people.
Yeah, they're lovely little things. I love our Australian birds. The smaller they are, the better. I love pardalotes.
Absolutely.
Pardalotes and the little scrub wrens and all those lovely little birds. And the little birds make so much noise. I mean, you think...
They do, don't they?
they're sort of... maybe it's nature's way of... compensating for their size or something, they make a hell of a noise. I've got my little, I don't know what's got, I'm just playing my little bird music here. It's not going to happen, All right, Chloe.
I'll email you through some of the pictures I took because they're pretty cool.
Yeah, I'll bet they are. Swiss parrot, I've read about them before. So that's good. Yeah. If their habitat's being maintained, habitat's the main thing in life. If you've got habitat for animals and even for humans, the habitat for humans too. We all need better habitat, I reckon.
Lots of trees.
lots of trees, and I sometimes think we're putting too many people into the country, but that's not my... But I just think it's hard to live, it's hard to adjust to great changes. We think we're adjustable and we do adjust, but in some ways we don't adjust to what's happening.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah, and you know, that's part of the whole mental health thing too. You know, if we spent more time in the trees, then maybe that would help too.
That's what they say. They say a walk in the trees, in the bush, is better than a walk along the footpath.
Absolutely.
Good on you, Chloe.
No worries. Thanks for listening to me today.
It's a pleasure. Good on you. Bye.
Bye.
Louise, where are you?
I'm in the beautiful Blue Mountains. It's a gorgeous day up here today.
Mm-hmm. In the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, yes.
In New South Wales, yes. And I was just ringing in to promote our quilt show. It's the last day today. It's at Warrimoo at John Whitecliffe School. And we have 15 stall holders, amazing quilts from all over the state. And we raise money for a women's refuge in Katoomba.
And that's at Warrimoo. I love quilts. My mum used to make quilts and bits and pieces and stuff and do all that sort of stuff. And that's how come I get to love it. I've been to some quilt shows, and a lady in Toowoomba, what was her name, Kel, sent me that lovely quilt of the night sky. It was dark blue, and she'd put little diamonds, because I wouldn't be here if she'd put diamonds on it, but if you know what I mean.
Lovely,
just these little,
lovely.
What was her name, Kel? She's sort of famous quilter. And it was lovely, and I've got it at home, and it's like a dark blue thing. It's about a metre by a metre, and it's
right.
And there's little. Was it Morley? I'm not sure. It might have been Morley, but little things like the night sky, like the Milky Way. It's just a beautiful thing. And I went to one in Melbourne, a quilt show, and it was just. Look, it's just breathtaking, and you see they do gums and native things and Swiss parrots and. It's just fantastic stuff. Morley Granger was the name, the quilter.
Right.
And she was in Toowoomba, and she sent me that. So yours is on in the Blue Mountains today at Warrimoo.
Yes. At Warrimoo Whitecliffe School, 10 till 4.
Mm-hmm.
We have a guest artist, featured quilter is Annie Downs, and she used to have a wonderful shop at Bathurst.
Uh-huh.
So she's there with all her quilts. And I just wanted to follow on from the gentleman that called in and said it is a community event that brings people together. And
exactly.
Just like you were saying, Macca, and our quilts, it's a biannual show, and we don't actually have a picture of the quilt. People just enter and we just accept everyone's quilt. So we don't really know what we're getting, but we have an amazing variety of quilts.
They're fantastic.
Yes, we've got a steam train quilt, we've got birds, we've got unicorns. It's a fantastic show.
And people do all sorts of things, and they can do sort of postmodern quilts and
yes,
stuff like that.
Yes,
all sorts of stuff, and a bit of art is great, Louise. It's just
that's right. Mindfulness, and it keeps people busy and takes them away from their everyday.
And I love to talk about quilters and quilts, because every time I do, I think about my dear mum. working away with your little spinning wheel, and she'd do stuff and she'd get things, and then she'd do a cross section of some sort of nut, and then she'd sew it and do it onto a quilt, and yeah, all sorts of stuff. Beautiful. I'd love to be there. Warrimoo Whitecliff School.
Whitecliff School, yep, 10 till 4 today.
Are you a quilter, Louise?
I am. It keeps me, it keeps my mind busy, and sometimes I'll wake up in the morning and think, that's how I'm going to do that. And I've met some lovely people, really, really lovely people. So it's a great little industry to be in and hobby.
It's like any hobby. It's like playing the guitar. You think about it all the time. You can never go through life saying, oh, well, everything's fine. I'll sit down and do this. No. There's always always something to do.
There's always something. Yeah. There is, and it's great to get out there and meet people. We've had lovely comments, and we've got a cafe as well, and really good shop stall holders too that have come from all over Sydney. So, to have them all in one spot for people to shop, it's a real treat.
Getting together, good on you, Louise.
Good. Thank you so much, Macca. It's
a pleasure.
Hello, Macca. This is Bob Backway here calling from the Lake Eyre Yacht Club in Maree, sunny South Australia.
Uh-huh.
I was just wondering if you and your listeners are aware of the proposal by the South Australian government to totally ban entry into Katisandra Lake Eyre National Park for any purpose.
No, I'm not aware of. There's lots of things we're not aware of, I suppose, Bob. And how do you know about that?
Yeah. How do I know about that? I'm a stakeholder on the National Park as Commodore of the Lake Eyre Yacht Club. They've been trying to prevent us boating on the lake since 2011, but the latest proposal, and people can see it if they search for Have Your Say in the South Australian Government website, is that there is absolutely no access to any person for any purpose whatsoever into Lake Eyre National Park.
From when? Now, when's the proposal? From when?
Well, from when the proposal is accepted. It's in the consultation period at the moment. That's why it's on the Have Your Say website, the South Australian Government.
Uh-huh.
The thing is that when the particular Indigenous group were given native title over Lake Eyre, the native title people specifically stated that they were to have non-exclusive access to the lake. But now it appears they're going to have exclusive access to the lake, and there'll only be like viewing areas on the edge of the national park, and people will only be able to stand at the viewing area and look out over it. They won't be able to recreate in a recreation area at all anymore.
So, Bob, people who want to look at this, what's the site where they go to with the South Australian government if they want to make a comment?
It's called Have Your Say. If they Google Have Your Say, Katisandra Lake Eyre National Park, they will find it.
Okay.
The Lake Eyre Yacht Club website.
I don't know. Sorry, I'm just talking to a producer. Go on.
If people go to the Lake Eyre Yacht Club website or, most conveniently, the Lake Eyre Yacht Club Facebook page, there's a lot of detail there.
All right.
We've only been working on this for just over a week since we found out about this. The other thing that your listeners might be interested in is the railway siding Curtamurca is a place of national significance. You'd no doubt know about the Curtamurca balls that used to be there.
Curtamurca.
I went up there to have a look at it the other day. I regularly go around here checking sites that where tourists go. And there's now a fence and a locked gate across a public road preventing access into Curtamurca Railway siding. I just can't believe what's going on up here at the moment. There's fences cropping up everywhere and locked gates on public land.
All right. Good on you, Bob. Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Rightio. Thank you, Macca. Bye.
Thanks, mate. Bye.
Hi, Macca. This is Mac here. And I'm going to talk about Anzac Day.
Yes, Mac. Yeah. Where are you, Mac?
Tugan.
Oh, Tugan. Yep. Been to Tugan. Yep.
I'm on Anzac Day. I marched with my granddad and I had my great granddad's miniature medals on, and I recited a poem in Flanders Fields. in front of more than 21 people.
You're a little possum. Do you want? How old are you, Mac?
8.
You're a little possum. Do you want to recite in Flanders Field for us now, or is that too much pressure? Or
no. In Flanders Field, where the poppies blow, between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky, the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders Field. Take up our quarrel with the foe, to you from failing hands we throw. The torch be yours, to hold it high, if ye break faith with us who die. We shall not sleep though poppies grow in Flanders Field.
You're a little champion, Mac. You want to come in here one morning and work with me? Come and do a few bits and pieces? Or I'll see you in Tugan. That's the deal. So was that exciting to do that, Mac? You enjoyed that?
Yeah.
Were you a bit nervous in front of all those people?
Not really.
Mm. No, yeah, go on.
I even made my granddad cry.
Well, granddads will do that. Granddads will do that, and grandmas too. They tend to get some tears now and again, but he was just probably pretty proud of you, Mac.
Yeah. Because he was a clearance diver.
I see. That's a top job too. A tough job too, being a clearance diver. I spoke to a bunch of clearance divers some years ago. They were having a get together somewhere along the coast somewhere. I forget where it was, but I spoke to a bunch of them, and they told me about once you get down in the water and it's cold or it's muddy or you can't see what you're doing and looking for it, all very dangerous.
Yeah.
All right, Mac. Go on, sorry.
My granddad stopped a few bombs.
There you go. So, what are you doing today, Mac? Quick.
Probably staying at home doing something.
Just hang around.
It's my dad's presentation day for Nippers. It's presentation day for Nippers.
Are you in the Nippers?
Yep.
Oh, good on you. I think Nippers is great. I wish I'd have been a nipper. A swimming nipper. All right, Mac, good on you, mate. Thank you for that, and thank you for the poem. And, I'll see you in Tugan sometime. You keep in touch.
Thanks, Mac.
It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.